Okay, thank you all for coming here, Miguel. It's great to have this event here. Our club, our association, Miguel Entertainment Sports Law Association, is proud to welcome the Writers Guild of Canada for this event. So I will start by presenting the panelists. Marc Lapointe, called to the Quebec Bar in 1992, Marc Lapointe has been working in the film and television industry for over a decade, beginning with film financing at the law firm of Desjardins, Ducharme, Steyn, Monast. He moved on to become a production lawyer for the Attraction Media Group, lending his expertise to high-profile projects such as the multiple award-winning feature Crazy and the hit series Naked Josh. He is now co-owner of the Omada Agency, the largest literary agency in Quebec, specializing in talent working behind the camera. He works closely with writers and directors, among others, and his interest, knowledge, and screenwriting go far beyond the negotiation of industry agreements, making him an asset to his clients in all aspects and stages of their projects. I'll hand the microphone to Ivana, who's going to...
Hello everyone. So my name is Ivana Chaskuti, and I'm one of the two presidents of the McGill Entertainment and Sports Law Association. So our second panelist is Dean Chinoy, and he focuses his practice on media and entertainment law, specifically film, television, publishing, and video gaming. He has extensive experience in production and project financing, international and interprovincial co-productions, protection of intellectual property, and talent negotiation. Mr. Chinoy has acted as counsel to Hollywood studios, Canadian broadcasters and distributors, independent production companies, and Canadian, U.S., and U.K.-based lenders involved in the financing of films and television projects. Mr. Chinoy has been a lecturer with the Faculty of Law at McGill University. He is a member of the junior board of the Grand Ballet Canadien de Montréal, the Montreal Chamber Music Festival, and a volunteer with the Young Professionals Committee of the Opera of Montreal. Our third panelist is Jasmine Spee, who has a BA in History and English from McGill University and an LLB from Queen's University. She has worked for the Writers Guild of Canada since 2008, where she has stewarded both long-form and series files. Prior to working at the WGC, she practiced real estate and corporate law and worked in arts policy at a National Arts Service organization. And finally, I will introduce to you the Quebec counselor for the Writers Guild of Canada, Ms. Anne-Marie Prada.
Hi. Thanks for coming. As you know, I'm the counselor for Quebec for the Writers Guild of Canada. We represent over 2,000 professional screenwriters across the country. We work in new media, digital series, features, animation, and that's a whole lot of contracts, as Jasmina would tell you. We are currently underway with negotiations with the producers' associations in Quebec and the rest of Canada, and we can't talk about that because it's really top secret. Alex Epstein or Epstein? Epstein, I know, I always do this, and we've known each other for years. He had this wonderful idea for this panel, so I'm going to turn over the show to him.
So basically, I mean, I started as a development executive, and I wrote a lot of contracts, and then became a professional writer, and I read a lot of contracts, and then I've also worked with a lot of writers who haven't had the advantage of working on so many contracts, and so have not always got the things that maybe they should have got in their contract. So I thought we should do a panel here on what do I want in my contract. And the basic idea here is that the IPA, the Independent Production Agreement, which is the minimum deal that you get as a Writers Guild member, contains many things, and that's really not what we're going to be here to discuss, because that's fairly well known for the Writers Guild membership, and it's not negotiable. So you just get those things if you're a member of the Writers Guild, or if you are working with a producer who is signatory with the Writers Guild. These are the issues that are up for grabs in a negotiation. So, but obviously, not all of you are going to be familiar with the IPA. So the first question we're going to address is what is the IPA, and you know, what sort of rights does it guarantee Jasmine Spee?
So this is the IPA. I'm not going to go over everything that's in it, but the basic this basic existence theme that covers minimums for live action writers in all kinds of disciplines. It really covers minimums just for script writing. We also cover story editors and story consultants under this agreement, so that means that their contracts, if they're members or if they're working for a signatory producer, do come under this agreement, but we don't set minimum fees for that. We also govern working conditions over and above actual monetary.
That's where producers are not actually allowed to be.
Yes. So basic working conditions, like the retention of copyright in your work, credit, you know, what your minimum credit should be, what your credit should be, what it should look like, if you have an issue with the credit, how we resolve that. And then we obviously provide for other benefits for members, such as insurance and retirement benefits. That's all in here, too. So that's kind of, you know, the two-second synopsis of this. But, yeah, so minimum working conditions, minimum fees, that's what the IPA is for.
Okay, so, Mark, are there producers who won't work with the Guild or won't work Guild? And what do you do if you're... you know, a writer who isn't yet a member of the Writers Guild who's dealing with a producer who is uncomfortable with the Guild, or if you're a non-member of the Writers Guild, you know, who would like to work Guild, but, you know, there's a resistance.
As long as you're not expecting me to name anyone, I'm fine with that question. Yes, Alex, there are indeed producers who don't want to work with the IPA. And before I even continue with that thought, I want everyone to know that I work here in the province of Quebec, which means that there aren't that many producers who produce material in English. So obviously, I'm going to talk about my experiences here, and we'll let the writer people here talk about the rest of the Canadian experiences of the WGC. So basically, yes, there are indeed producers who are uncomfortable with working with the IPA. Mostly all Francophone producers would decide to produce in English, and there are a lot, much more now, because there's so little money on the French side, so why not try to get money on the English side? And one of the situations that we see a lot, and we'll be able to talk more about this later on, it's that, for instance, option money in Francophone productions, it's very, very low, and if you stick to the IPA minimum, an option is almost 10 times some of the money that the producers are used to paying as far as option fees are concerned. So obviously you get the point that that's scary for a lot of producers. So yes, there are indeed a lot of producers who are very scared, but once you talk to them and you try to... For me, the secret is always trying to work with the producers and not working against them. I'm not fighting with producers. I'm just trying to find a solution to whatever situation. The producers who don't want to work with the IPA, whether they're Francophones or Anglophones, it'll depend on the budget. Small productions, anyways, there are. Jasmine, you can help me out on this one. But there are options to you can work with certain amounts if the budgets are lower than these amounts. Well, anything is negotiable up to a certain point. And if not, well, I would never recommend to our clients to work outside of the WGC if they are members. And if they're not members, well, it's not the same situation. But those who are members, I would never recommend doing that unless it's for a very, very small budget.
Dean, do you want to talk about what might be the source of resistance from the producers? What are the things that really make it difficult for producers here?
Well, it's going to be a producer who's not a member of the producers' association, because by virtue of the fact that you're a member of the producers' association, you're bound to adhere to the IPA. And if your writer is a guild writer, you're also bound to hire the writer correct from the guild. So the person who's going to be hiring non-guild writers is a writer who's starting out the business, not a member of the WGC, and the producer who's trying to make a lower budget picture. Because if you go with the minimums in the IPA, that producer is going to say it's too much money for you on the lower budget picture.
And if you're dealing with that mindset, are these insurmountable issues, or are they just whining on the part of producers, or is it that there is a legitimate resistance that can be overcome?
I mostly represent producers, so I'll be the producer.
That's what you're here for.
You know, raising money to make a film is a Sisyphean task. It's almost impossible in today's day and age to raise money, so anything that saves a producer money in terms of getting a picture made is going to be beneficial to you. If it's a higher budget picture where there is a lot of financing, then I think it would be a tough argument to be made that you can't pay.
Okay, so in order to for a producer, well, I just want to briefly address the voluntary recognition agreement, which is a piece of paper that a producer must have signed for the Guild to intervene if there is anything going wrong with your contract. So, Jasmine, tell us what it is and why you need one.
So, a voluntary recognition agreement, the VRA, is really the document the producer signs that adheres them to the IPA, meaning that they're working under the IPA, and we're able to enforce the terms of the IPA for the writer's contract. The situation is a bit different in Quebec because of status of the artists, where any producers who are members of the APFDQ are automatically signatories to the IPA, so they don't actually physically have to sign off on a VRA, but any of those producers who aren't members of that producers association do have to if they're working with a member writer. And as Alex said, without a VRA, we don't have jurisdiction over your contract, notwithstanding your membership. So that's kind of our first thing we say to all members, is make sure the company you are signing the contract with has signed the VRA. I mean, we keep records of everything. You can call, you can check, because without it, and everything may be going swimmingly, and you may not realize, and you may not know, and then you'll run into an issue, and you'll obviously call the Guild, because that's what we're there for. But unfortunately, we don't have the teeth to back anything up on your agreement, even if your agreement says it's a WDC agreement, if that VRA is not in place. And a lot of times, it's very important to check with us, because you may be working directly with a parent company, with a bigger production company, but they may have incorporated a single-purpose company for the point of just your project, or they have separate development companies that they work with. And once again, this is a bit different in Quebec, because the status of the artist, that we're all APFDQ production companies are signatories, but in the rest of Canada, all those separate companies do need to be separate signatories.
Mark, do you just want to quickly address single-purpose companies? Because I've noticed often my contracts, the contract isn't actually with the production company, it's with a single-purpose company, and I have no idea how I go after those guys if they fail to pay.
A single-purpose company, and Dean, you can help me out. Basically, it's for tax credit purposes. Most productions in Canada are financed in a very large proportion by tax credits, meaning that it's a credit on your tax that you have to pay the income tax. So basically, it's much simpler for productions to keep a close accounting if you have a single purpose entity. There's also the question that certain expenses will be only for the production entity that's created the single purpose entity. So it becomes a complete problem if you have, for instance, production office for this production. There's the mother company, which is the producers that we know and hear about. And then they'll make a film called Great Film Inc., great title. But they also make a television show called whatever TV show. And at some point, they'll set up a production office for whatever TV show, and it's production office for Great Film. And they'll be buying some material for one, material for the other. They'll be renting for one, renting for the other. So at some point, I imagine, Dean, that becomes impossible to clearly manage and then present a request for a tax credit. And that tax credit is the, as I said, one of the main portions of the financing of the film or the television series.
Well, Dean, say I have a deal with a single-purpose company, and then there's a failure to, you know, pay an obligation in the contract, do I have any recourse? Because I can't, the single-purpose company doesn't really have any assets. So is this ever practically a problem, or is everybody...
No, you would have no recourse against the parent company because you have a single-purpose vehicle that entered into the contract with you. It's very hard to sue the shareholder of the company. You could make potentially a claim, but I don't think you would have a direct...
So what do I need to do in order to make my contract enforceable?
You'd have to have the parent company or the shareholder intervene and sign, which they won't do.
So then practically, Mike, does that make all of my contracts sort of essentially meaningless or what?
Well, but in Quebec, as Jasmine pointed out, if you're a member of the APFTQ, then you are bound, and so that the Writers Guild would have a claim against the parent company for a breach of the contract. Outside of Quebec would be different.
So, Jasmine, the Writers Guild would have a claim. What can the Writers Guild actually do? Because the Writers Guild, unlike the WGA, doesn't go around suing people.
So that's where it all comes back to the VRA. I mean, you may think the parent company is a signatory, but that absolutely does not protect you if your contract is Best TV Show Ever, Inc., because that production company is producing the best TV show ever. So that's why we absolutely ask you to double-check who is actually the producer on your contract. Because all your conversations with your agent and directly with the producer might be with big production company, but when you see your contract, that company that's issuing it, that's listed as producer, may be Big TV Company, Inc. So we ask you to double-check that that company is the signatory to the WGA for the purposes of your contract. And at that point, yes, something goes wrong, then we can absolutely use all the mechanisms within the IPA, whether it's grievance or arbitration, to make sure that everything in your contract is enforced.
But is grievance and arbitration, the Writers Guild have teeth? Do they sick dogs on people? Or is it just very Canadian and, you know, that's wrong, eh? And you shouldn't do that. And then the producer goes, oh, you're right, I shouldn't do that.
It's not, I mean, I'm not going to lie and say that if you come to us and say, I haven't gotten paid, we're going to get you paid tomorrow, but we do have our process. As far as I know, we've never not gotten anything for a writer. And yet, as your representative of the guild is allowed to negotiate and settle on your behalf, but I know the process can be lengthy at times, especially if it does go to arbitration, but once it goes to arbitration, I mean, it is enforceable by the courts. We absolutely take it to the furthest ends of the earth that we can, whether it's sending a sheriff to knock on a door to enforce, you know, an arbitration settlement. Yeah, we'll absolutely do that because that's, you know, that's our jurisdiction. Those are the powers we have.
Great.
Alex, if I may... another thing is the reputation of the producers. Obviously, if you're working with a reputable producer who produces a lot of films and TV shows in the province, they're not going to waste their reputation on not paying you a certain portion of your contract. So, and since the writers are involved early on in the process, and generally speaking, well, on the first day of principal photography, they get the bulk of whatever they're supposed to get. I know you want to talk about participation in profits later on, but the real money stops on the first day of principal photography for a writer. If the producer doesn't have any more money, then there's no film, obviously. So the risks for a writer are much smaller. The risks that you may have are early on in the process, before there's actually any real film going on, where you're just beginning to write and you have an option and you're promised a certain amount of money. With a small producer, they'll promise you a really small amount of money for a first draft, kind of like, we'll give you $2,500 for your first draft kind of thing. Well, you could technically have problems getting paid that amount. But if you're signing with a real producer with real money, the reputation...
Mark, I actually once got stiffed $200 on it for being paid $1,000 to write a script early on. You're getting your material out there, and the first thing that happens is they're going to hand this waiver to you. The CBC makes you sign a waiver. A lot of production companies make you sign waivers. And these waivers are actually pretty scary because they actually say that they started saying that if the producer gets anything that looks anything like your material script or, you know, idea or material, or if it's identical to yours, then you have no right or recourse against the producer for the use of these identical or similar materials. Jasmine, how is this not unconscionable?
It's not a situation that the guild is at the point that the guild is involved. You're right, it's smelly. It's an industry thing, and I mean, we can't stop you from signing it.
So let's, so Mark, you want to address these things?
I guess that will be one.
And the corollary is that does this really become an issue, or is it just a piece of paper that everybody has to sign and nobody really, you know, just steals ideas?
I guess it's a bit of both. In the sense, we don't see that that very often as agents, because when material comes through us, producers never ask that of us. They know that if we're involved, it's a different game. So I guess it becomes the equivalent of solicited material up to a point. There are producers asking for this. In Quebec, it's very, very rare. But there are. I imagine American producers.
That's from the CBC release.
Okay. Aside from the CBC, I guess. But I never get ever. People will actually call me and say, would you rep me for this script because they're asking me to sign this or to have somebody solicit their script. And I will say no, in the sense that we only represent people for their careers, not just for one script. But so we don't face that very often.
So Dean, are these absolutely necessary for producer, and are they at all negotiable?
I think the reasoning for these type of waivers is the amount of litigation which occurs relating to copyright claims. It's more of an American thing. You don't see it as much in Canada. In the U.S., anything unsolicited, you have to sign these type of waivers. At the end of the day, if somebody outright steals your script and doesn't change anything and produces it without your permission, I don't think this waiver would be a bar to a copyright infringement case. But if people change it slightly or make an argumentation that they create something substantially similar, then the waiver would prevent you from having a lawsuit. Would protect the producer. I think it's geared towards a much more litigious society. Canada is not as litigious as the United States. Everybody sues. That's why most producers don't take unsolicited material in the United States. And if they do, the waiver is much more extensive than this. It would be quite detailed, a few pages long. You know, the best way for your script to be provided to a producer is through a reputable agent. And then there's a certain trust. And like Mark said before, if a producer goes around screwing people, they're not going to be in the business.
I'll just add that in my experience, these are a little bit negotiable. I've usually been able to get the identical word struck out. You know, because there's really no good argument for why they would have something identical. So to a certain extent, you can look at it and see if you can make some reasonable changes. So somebody gets your material, they love it, they want to option it. Let's talk about options for features. So Jasmine, tell us what the contestants get
so
under the IPA.
Basic IPA minimums for an option is 10% of your purchase price for the material, and the purchase price are the minimums in the IPA. So for a full feature script, currently it's $51,189. So your minimum option fee under the IPA would be 10% of that per 12-month period. That payment can be prorated, you know, every 2 months, every 6 months, as long as that amount is paid out at the end of the 12 months. We do have a provision in there where a short option of 3 months or shorter, those option fees can be negotiable, but that's it in terms of negotiating the minimums. And an option contract can provide for term renewals, but the total length of the option cannot be longer than 4 years. So you can have an initial option of 12 months and then have 3 one-year renewals at that same option fee, the 10%. After your option contract has expired, never minding what the length of it is, if it's 2 years, if it's 4 years, if you're looking to re-option your material with another producer or with that same producer, it would be a brand new option contract reflective of the rates that were in place at the time of the new option contract. If you lock yourself in for an option contract now over the next 4 years, those rates stay the same over the course of the contract. We don't have lower option rates for lower budget features. So the option, we do have lower budget rates for, you know, commissioning a script, for hiring a writer to write a script, but the option fees don't get reduced for lower.
So Dean, $5,000 to option a script. Is that realistic in Quebec? And if not, what?
I think it's realistic if you have a reasonable size budget. If it's a producer who's trying to make a film for a budget of $500,000, then that's a substantial sum. If it's a few million dollars, $5,000 is a development cost. I have producers argue that's reasonable.
Mark, you want to talk about when you go to Quebec producers and ask for $5,000, how does that work out?
The ones who are used to it now and have had the debates with me already, that's pretty, it's gotten easier. But it's always, I'm not going to give you all of my tricks. But I can tell you that there are ways of being creative with the IPA in the sense that, yes, there are shorter options, periods that are not, for instance, well, you said 3 months. Well, you can always have a bunch of options, 3-month options with renewals. But what I would always do is recommend that in the end, for the duration, the amount is equivalent to the minimum WGC IPA option amount. It's just a way of saying to the producer, we know you want to start developing right now, and you're telling us you don't have $5,000 to put onto the table right now, but maybe you can give us $1,250 every 3 months or whatever. I didn't do the math there, but something like that to reduce the actual, put the whole money on the table right now kind of thing.
What if the producer says, I just don't have $5,000, but all I want to do is take this thing around and we won't negotiate the deal yet, but I want to be attached if I manage to set it up. Is that a deal that can be done?
I imagine, but it would be a bad deal.
would that be a bad deal for the writer?
For the writer, yeah.
But at that point, once the thing is set up, you can negotiate a better deal, can't you?
I would tell you, I'll just do a little. For smaller productions, you have a script and you want to option it out to a producer. If a producer offers you a dollar, he's the wrong producer. That's a given. Okay, that's something to think about outside of the IPA. IPA wise, there are many producers out there, and if you have a good script, you shouldn't think that the first person that says I want to option it out and then offers you a dollar is the only person that will ever offer you at least a dollar for your script. So the point is, if one producer doesn't want to play by the rules, well, then you don't necessarily have to go with that producer, and you'll evaluate your own capacity to sustain risk. That'll be a big part of it. If you're the producer in question is one of your friends, and they want to try this out with you, and you want to try it out with them because you want to produce a film with your friend, then anything pretty much goes. If they say, well, we won't take an option now because it is a $5 million budget, and so there's no way we can go without respecting the IPA, you can always do whatever you want. It's a question of risk. It's your friends. But for me, if it's a ridiculously low amount for an option, that's just not the right producer.
So great. So now we've optioned the script. Typically, at that point, producer's going to want to rewrite it. Hopefully by you. Hopefully in your contract it says it has to be by you. In order to, if you are trying to go for rewrite money from Telefilm, there's a rewrite proposal that needs to be made. If you sold an idea, you basically have to turn in, it turns out to be a 10 to 15 page treatment of a feature film script, which pretty much in my book is like the hard work of writing a script. Do you ever get paid for these things? Jasmine, do you have to get paid for this treatment? And if not, how do you get paid for this?
Right. So we know that Telefilm has this requirement to access the first level of funding. The Guild defines treatment as much longer than 10 to 15 pages as our basic definition, so we see it as at least twice that. How we advise writers is that, no, those 10 to 15 pages, that can be considered an outline by the Guild, and outlines are something that we consider development material, and development material is not covered automatically by the IPA. So we absolutely let our writers, if they want to, negotiate a fee for those 10 to 15 pages to be able to access that first level of telephone funding. However, that contract and that fee can't be used against any subsequent contract for writing. So if you access that first level of funding through your outline, we expect a full WGC contract at the full WGC rate to follow from that.
So Mark, what would you be asking, you know, if you have a writer who has sold an idea, the producer wants, you know, this 10 to 15 page, it's an outline, it's a treatment.
If you're expecting me to give out an amount, I'm not.
Okay.
But I will tell you, all of you, one thing. Competition is so fierce now in order to get money, because the way it works, I don't know if that's a sad thing, but it's the way it works here in Quebec. Producers who actually invest real money at the beginning of any production, they're rare. They're very rare. They work with Telefilm and Sodec money. That's where they get their money. Even though they say that it's their money, they got it from Telefilm or Sodec first. And now the competition is so fierce that you have, at every application deadline, you have like 200 applications going in at Telefilm and 200 going in at Sodec. And if you're just thinking of your own chances of getting that thing done, because you won't get paid if it doesn't get funded and if it doesn't get, well, get and the rest. So basically, you, as a writer, you absolutely want this to be better than all of the other projects that have been submitted to the application at that period. So basically, yes, there's the 15-page for Telefilm, and as an agent of a writer, my first reflex is to try to see if I can get always get some kind of payment for the work that's done at the very first stage. Of course, that's our objective, but we also have to keep in mind what the situation here is here in Quebec and think, now some producers, they have 25-page outlines with pictures and blah, blah, blah to try to get that money. And even though it's starting to get ridiculous because people are working 25 pages, there you have to try to find a compromise at some point. If you want this thing funded, you want it to look the best and be the best of the whole 100 bunch other scripts that are all proposed to Telefilm and Sodec at the same time.
Okay, so now I want to talk about there's a standard purchase price for a script, which is in the IPA, and there's also something called a production fee, which is a percentage of the budget that slides around depending on how much the budget is. That gives you a substantial fee should your movie be made. Those are all covered in the IPA, so we're not really going to get into them. I wanted to get into some of the things that you can put in your contract that are sort of things, if your movie is very successful, as God willing it will be, what are the things that you can ask for in your contract so that if your movie is a huge hit, you get some benefits? So one of the first things that comes to mind is your right to write additional materials. And that, Jasmine, that's really not something that's in the IPA at all.
No, I mean, you obviously support it, and if it's in your contract, if you codify that, then we can enforce it for you.
So, Mark, how comfortable are producers giving this away?
A lot of them are, actually. Depending on the kind of production that will follow, whatever stage do you want your right of first refusal for? Obviously, if you're applying to write a first draft, I mean, it's going to be you. The rewrite, normally you should be the person asked to do it, and you have a contract to go a certain way. And Jasmine, I do believe that WGC does protect the writer at various stages. Well. But if the first right of refusal, the right of first refusal is, for instance, for a remake or for a sequel or a prequel or a spin-off, which we'll talk more about later on, well, if it's your first feature and you've never written any TV whatsoever, you might have a problem getting this right for instance, spin-offs, to television spin-offs of your feature. Remakes, it's not too hard to get in the English language because most of the time there aren't that many remakes. It's more going from French to English is much more something you'll see much more often. And then the French writer can get, I mean, you have to be, there aren't that many bilingual writers
anywhere in the world.
Dean, how comfortable are producers with something like this?
I think it would be very rare in Canada that you do remakes of films. I think a spin-off, like he said, if you're a writer who has written for television, then it's going to be a difficult thing to negotiate. But if you're a writer who has done TV and features, I think you can negotiate it. And it was something that a producer would be open to because it's all about quality and ability. I've seen writers who keep the remake rights for foreign languages. I've seen producers keep that as well. I think it's a very lucrative type of activity now, particularly for producers in Quebec who make French language films. We've been seeing a lot of French language Quebec films being remade in other languages.
Is there a difference between a remake and selling the format rights?
Format is more seen more in television. For a type of a show. Like we've seen in Quebec, we have Taxi Vendeur, which has been optioned by HBO for James Gandolfini, or we've seen Un Gars, which has been remade in the U.S. Format really applies more to TV. Feature films, there isn't really a format.
Would you have in your contract that you're attached to the format rights somehow, or would the producer never get that away?
I think you'd attach a revenue stream. The format rights. If you're a well-known writer, I think you can negotiate that. If it's a concept which is wholly original with you and you developed it, you could argue that if there is format rights which are sold to other territories, then you get a payment of the royalty fee, which is paid for that.
Okay, and then the other thing is if you, for whatever reason, don't wind up writing these additional things, you can ask for passive payments. Does anybody want to jump in on that? Dean, you want to?
Well, that's what I was talking about. The passive payment means that if the foreign, you know, if, for example, they actually do a remake and you're not the one who wrote the script, you could say that I get X percentage of the budget or X percentage of the producer fee as a passive royalty going forward. Or if sequels, additional cycles, if you're the person that came up with a TV series, I've seen writers who say, I developed the Bible and going forth, I get a payment per show. And I get an executive producer credit or story editor credit or something like that. So a passive royalty is something that if you're an established writer, I would suggest you negotiate.
And incidentally, these are, so far as I'm aware, these are kind of not unheard of numbers. So, you know, if there's a sequel to your feature, then you could wind up getting just handed a check for half of whatever you got on the feature. When somebody else makes another feature that you don't write based on it. So, you know, if you're Patrick Huard and you invented the idea of Bon Cop, Bad Cop, which nobody did because we ripped it off from, you know, Lethal Weapon, but let's say you came up with the idea and then somebody else does Bon Cop 2, which they won't because Patrick still has the rights, but let's say he had sold the rights, then he could wind up with a check for 50% of whatever he got paid. And then if there was, you know, a spin-off of one of the characters, then it would be less, but you can still get some money.
And the IPA does provide the character and concept royalties for that baseline. If from your original script, a spin-off or a sequel or a prequel is created, we do have minimums for for character or concept payment.
So in other words, if there's a character in the TV show, so you write, as a freelancer, you write an episode where this kooky guy comes onto the TV, onto Flashpoint, and he's a professional clown. And then the CTV goes, hey, that's a great, let's do a series about the professional clown. Then you would see continuing payments.
Yep. It's continuing payments, yeah. Every time that character is reused, a percentage of the original script fee does get paid to you as a minimum. It's 15% per character under the IPA. Of course, we encourage negotiations over and above that, as these passive payments oftentimes can be. But there is something in the IPA that secures you a minimum if your character or your concept goes on to spurn further production.
So let's suppose that things don't work out as wonderfully as in the previous scenario, and they've optioned your script. They batted around town for a couple of years, and they don't manage to make it. In the meantime, you've been hired to write a rewrite. Well, there are two issues I want to talk about here. One is, in the IPA, there is a turnaround. So that's basically where, if they bought your script and nothing happens for 5 years, you just get it back.
So the basic number in the IPA is 7 years. So if they paid you to write a script, and they have it, and your contract doesn't say anything else about reversion, they haven't produced it for 7 years, all the rights revert back to you. That is one of the numbers that is negotiable in the IPA. So there can be a clause in your contract that says 2 years, and reverts back, or there can be a clause in your contract that says no reversion.
Ah, I didn't know that.
but you don't have to agree to that, but if it's silent, it's 7 years.
So, but, you know, if I'm a writer and I've created a script and then I do a rewrite, it becomes very difficult for me to separate the rewrite from the script. I can't really go and, you know, if the option expires, I get my original script back, but I don't get the rewrite back. It's very hard for me to take to write another draft of the script that doesn't have any of the ideas from the rewrite. So, Dean, what would I want to do in that case?
The most important thing is to outline from the beginning the controls you have over the script, so that if you're going to get into a situation where you're rewriting an original script where your chain of title is not clear, it'll be very problematic.
Mark, what would you advise a writer optioning a script who's got the writer first refusal to do a rewrite, but the producer will own the rewrite, whereas he'll only option the script. So what can you do?
It's always going to end up being the producer will want to get paid for whatever he's paid. So basically, and then anyways, if he's got telefilm money and SODEC money, these will remain attached to the project. And if another producer picks them up, these investments are into the loop, and there's some money that has to be paid back to the producer.
Okay, but would you advise? But if there's nothing in your contract, you can't just insist on buying the rewrite back. That would become negotiable. Whereas if you put something in your contract.
We'll always try to put something in the contract. I'm not sure we're going to get that far with it, but we'll always try. That's what agents try to do, is getting the best deal possible while remaining realistic.
The point I'm trying to make is you know, you want everything worked out in your contract in advance, because once things are moving forward, you have lost all your leverage. You've sold your script. Or you've optioned your script. The point at which you're doing, so I typically have in my contracts that I can get the rewrite back. I have to pay all the money back that I was paid. So I'm really, this is for asking another producer to do that. If another producer, another studio is buying the project, they can pay the first producer out and he's gone. Without that clause in the contract, then there's no guarantee the original producer may just say, no, I refuse. I'm keeping your rewrite, and you know, I want to produce it, and nobody else can produce it. So you always want to cover your bases there.
The deal will actually argue that if they don't ever exercise the option to the material, they don't actually acquire the rights.
To the rewrite?
To the rewrite or the second draft.
Oh, really?
We will actually argue that on their behalf, that no payment has to be made. We see any additional writing to an option script as being linked to the original script.
And is that in the IPA?
We interpret the IPA saying that. We obviously, a lot of producers interpret differently, but we have gone to master that, and I personally...
Should we maybe tighten that language up a little bit?
Yeah, especially, and obviously the issue pops up when it comes to repayment. That usually is when the issue pops up, if the writer then wants to take their project to a new producer. But the old producer, would be on the hook to telephone to pay the money back that they paid the writer for a rewrite or a second draft or some more work on that. That's usually when the issue will pop up. But the guild will insist to producers that the writer is never on the hook for that money.
Great. Let's talk about net profits. Is there anything in the IPA about sort of the writer's back end?
We do have a distributor's gross revenue that kicks in. It's 3.2% of the distributor's gross revenue once 100% of the budget has been recouped.
So that's different than sort of the American studio definition of monkey points.
Yeah, we don't have residuals, so because we have production fee, which Americans, the WWE doesn't have. So the writer secures that second payment for distribution, to secure distribution rights when they're project is produced, but yeah.
So is the distribution royalty worth money to people who have successful pictures?
No, it doesn't. I don't see those reports come in, but I believe, you could probably count on both hands the number of projects that pay through our system, which is why negotiating above and beyond that is very wise.
So Mark, how would you negotiate something above and beyond?
How?
Yeah. Well, I mean, just like, what would you? What kind of thing would a writer want to be asking for? Is it a different kind of beast that you're looking for? And
the point is that yes, there aren't any profits, so to speak, in Canada, so to speak. So technically, you would think that it's easier to negotiate some back-end profit, whatever, participation. Not necessarily. It's not easier because of the fact that there never is. But it's still a good idea to try to get as much as possible whenever you can, because the fluke case that one film makes it big time and there is some money, well, then you'll be laughing all the way to the bank. And at the same time, the producer isn't signing much of anything, because that doesn't happen very much to begin with. So, of course, we'll try to get as much as possible. And one of the arguments that will have to be had eventually during the process is the definition of what the participation is payable on. There's we all know the words gross and net, but gross and net mean pretty much whatever you define them as meaning in a contract.
Do you want to address Canadian net profits? Are there ever Canadian net profits?
I've never seen a film turn a net profit.
Is that a more legitimate lack of profit than the American system, where there are people who are driving limos around who have never made a profit?
Well, the history of net profits in the U.S. has been based on what's called rolling accounting. So the studios have been nailed for creating films which have very fancy accounting so that you never go into a net profit position. So a film that can make hundreds of millions of dollars, the studio will argue, based on advertising costs and built-in costs and overhead costs, you won't get into that position. In Canada, we have very, particularly telefilm-funded films, have very strict definitions of how the money is distributed and what type of actual revenues can be held. But if you take a film which is the highest grossing film in Canada, let's say the last 10 years, the film, I don't believe, really got into a net profit situation, which is the film you worked on.
So we're going to talk about series. I know that Mark's not going to talk about option payments. I'm going to ask Jasmine, in terms of optioning your series, does the Guild have minimums?
We have minimums for optioning your pilot script and any script material, and they apply the same as they do with features, 10% of what the purchase price is, purchase price being the script fee minimum in our agreement. We don't have minimums for something like a concept.
Dean, could you speak into the microphone?
So, yes, there are no minimums for a Bible, so that is negotiable between a producer and a writer. So I think, I'll change my hat for a minute. I'll wear the WGC hat.
Okay.
Writer hat. I think that's shortchanging writers. I think there should be something in there, because when one is going to produce a TV series, you need a Bible, and there should be a minimum payments for a writer performing that. On the other hand, I'll put my producer hat on. And as a producer, it's very beneficial because you don't have any minimums, so you can negotiate a low cost because it's speculative. I were negotiating on behalf of a writer, Mark can say that, you would put a kicker. If it gets greenlit and a broadcaster comes on board, then there should be a payment made, which is substantially negotiated.
Yeah. Mark, is there any difference, Mark, in the structure of, how the producer gets paid, in that if a producer's funding a script, they're getting paid by Telefilm, there's no money coming down the pike to a producer of a television series until there's a broadcaster attached. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. But a broadcaster attached doesn't necessarily mean that they'll go all the way on a production. Normally, they might want to develop a few scripts, let's say, and give you some money, which will be less than the actual fee for one script. But that's the way it works in French Canada. I'm not so sure how it works in English Canada.
English Canada is the same.
Pretty much.
The CBC or other networks will ask that you write a few scripts so that they can give comments on the general direction of the series before they fully greenlight it.
But at that point, you're getting paid to write scripts.
Yeah.
So woohoo.
And not full payment.
Not full payment.
Not full payment.
No. A percentage of the actual cost for a whole say yes.
Do you want to address that?
I'm not sure. I mean, I get contracts all the time that are broadcasters asking for sample episodes that are WGC contracts. Yeah, there are WGC contracts with WGC. But I mean, they may not be pilot contracts, but...
Under the WGC, if you commission a full script, you have to get the full production fee.
If it goes into production, but in the development stage, I have lots of conversations with producers that are like, you know, they've ordered 1, 2, 3 test scripts. It's not greenlit yet. But I'll still see those contracts at our rates.
Are people still, has there been any shift towards writers specking pilots versus specking a Bible and then getting paid to write the pilot? Has that changed, the environment changed at all over the past few years?
Regarding spec writing?
In the States, it's typical for a writer to spec a pilot script. Nobody sells a Bible. In Canada, it used to be you could sell a Bible and then get paid to write the pilot script. Has that changed at all?
It'll just depend on the experience of the writer. If it's a very inexperienced writer, they'll try to... The producer won't want to get involved at all without at least the spec pilot. And I can only speak much more in the French world, but... Most of the time, you'll see 3 episodes when you're a young writer. And if I jump to the U.S. side, sometimes with young, inexperienced writers, you'll actually write an entire season before you get any kind of attention from anybody, because there is no, for a feature film, once it's written, it's written. They don't have to say, oh, will this person be able to write an entire feature? If they've optioned a full feature, it's a no-brainer, it's written. But writing one spec pilot doesn't necessarily mean that when it starts officially, the person will be able to turn out 10 scripts in a certain specific period of time. But that's in French Canada, because in French Canada, you don't have staffs. There's one writer for the whole series, or maybe 2 writers for a whole series. So it's very different. But if you're a very experienced writer, then it's another game. You'll be paid to write your pilot.
Dean, do you want to chip in?
I'm still seeing producers optioning Bibles. I'm not seeing as many spec scripts as you would in the U.S.
Okay, let's talk to the big hairy issue, the famous created by credit. What does the IPA say about the created by credit?
Nothing, but not yet. we don't govern it. If it's not in your contract, if you don't negotiate for it, we can't enforce it for you.
Do you gentlemen want to talk about this, by the way, you'll never see a clause this good. This is like, you know, my dream clause. Created by credit in the States is governed by who writes the pilot. The pilot episode credit is arbitratable. And what this practically means in the States is that whoever rewrites the pilot is going to try and change it as much as possible so that they get a credit on the script, so that they get created by. Do you guys want to talk a little bit about who... The real questions are, you know, if you have a junior writer, can they insist to have at least a shared created by credit? Is that prohibitive? The networks are often bringing on experienced showrunners to rewrite writers. What's the situation?
It's a really negotiable issue. You, as a writer, should be arguing for created by credit if you had a substantial input into the series. But if your series gets completely rewritten by a showrunner, I think the producer is going to try and argue that it's the showrunner that should be getting it. But it's a negotiable credit.
So, Mark, how do you negotiate that credit then?
Well, we'll just try to demonstrate that the core of the project comes from the writer that we represent.
But when you say the main core of the project comes from the writer, you would actually need to have contractual language guaranteeing it. You can't argue later on.
No, it would be from the... Yes, absolutely. That's a given thing, that from the get-go, in any contract, anything we're going to discuss here has to be pre-negotiated. When it's done, it's done. And you going back, forget it. But no, so created by in the French world, again, in television, I'm more uncomfortable in going at length, mainly because I'm mostly working French.
You can always ask Dean to put on his other hat.
But created by in French is not such an issue. It's not very difficult to get that, as long as the idea basic idea has been developed enough by the original writer for it to make sense.
Dean, suppose a producer comes to me and he scribbled an idea on a napkin, you know, snipers. And he wants me to, you know, create a series around that. Obviously, you get whatever you negotiate, not what you deserve. But can you speak to how that negotiation would go?
Well, you could say everybody has an idea, but you as the writer, where you're bringing value is the expression of the idea. And, yeah, he may have said, I want a show about snipers and, you know, in dresses, like female sniper team. But you're the one that provides...
Oh, now we're talking.
Yeah. I'm working on a female sniper show. You're the one that brings fruition because you bring depth to the characters and you bring the story, the backstory, and you're the one as the writer who've created the show that's viable and that the audience likes. So I think you come in, you say, you know, anybody could have come up with a concept. It's a high concept one-liner, but I'm the one that created the show.
And do you think a producer's going to walk away if he can't get his creative by credit from his napkin?
He won't if you've delivered a really compelling show and you haven't signed a contract yet, so he doesn't own it. So you could say, I'm not giving you the rights, even though every network in the U.S. wants the show, until you give me a share created by credit.
Typically, most of the pilot contracts that I do get and the Bible Ponders I do see, most of them I do see a created by credit negotiated for. Like, there's usually always some, like, it's rare to have it. You'll always get it no matter what, but at least it's in there. So either they all have really good agents or or it's become more common.
So let's talk about, in the previous slide, we had not subject to approvals. In a typical television contract, it's going to say network approval on everything. So I really have two questions. Is that, Dean, is that ever negotiable, network approval? And if it is not negotiable, what's to prevent the producer from going to the network and saying, I really don't want this writer's salary approved, or I really don't want this writer's credit approved, or I don't want this writer approved?
In Canada, the networks have such strong ties and strong opinions over television shows that you do have to include this clause, because the broadcaster is going to look at every aspect of the production and have something to say. And there are teams of people at the broadcasters who are paid to comment on the development of the show. So a producer who doesn't want to be in trouble is going to put this, because they know they're going to have to kowtow to the suggestions of the broadcaster. Is there a risk? They may say to the broadcaster, really, at the end of the day, I don't want you to approve this. I think on a practical level, sure, it's possible. But
do you ever see that happening, or do you have a suspicion that it happens?
I've never seen it happen per se, but I could fathom it. You know, if someone involved is creating problems for the production, I could see the producer saying that.
Can you disapprove?
Yeah, can you disapprove of this? But the broadcaster knows what's in their best interest, and if they have a writer who's written really strong scripts. And this is the person who's a creative vision, and more so, I think, in the Francophone community, because you have a number of well-known writers who have been showrunners and creators of strong TV shows. A broadcaster is going to want that person because it's a proven brand. Right? They know they deliver. They know they can have long-standing television shows with these creators, so the broadcaster is going to want to approve.
So in other words, you can be as difficult as you are talented.
Sure. Well, that's the nature of the business.
Okay, so you guys don't want to talk about numbers, so I'm just going to skip over some things. Let's talk about staffing. When you bring your idea to a producer, to what extent can you insist on being in on the show? Anybody want to answer that?
Again, if you have no experience, we will, of course, try to get you the highest number of guaranteed scripts to write for a show in a season. But it'll always be a balance between experience and what the broadcasters and network are expecting. We will cop out this saying, well, if this person doesn't get at least three scripts, well, then this person will at least get so much per script, per episode that they don't write. So there's an additional incentive for the producer to try working with this person, because they'll be paying them even if they don't work.
So your objective as a writer is to make it expensive to not hire you to do stuff.
I wouldn't say that's the objective, but I'm saying Of course, we just try to eliminate as much as possible the risks of a producer deciding not to continue working on with a writer. We cannot eliminate it completely, but we'll try to reduce it or to make it not such a good idea to stop working with somebody.
Dean, do you want to?
I think a good example for this, and I've done this, I represent writers who've written well-established comic books. And a producer will come to the writer and say, listen, I really like your comic book. I have an example. There was a comic book, and it's also webisodes. So they've created sort of with flash animation involving stories. So they have a cinematic approach. And they wanted to option the stories. You know, they have proven stories because they've had comic books which have a built-in audience. So I've negotiated that there'll be story consultants at a minimum. They'll get fees per episode. And they'll get write a first refusal to write scripts. And if the scripts are good, then they'll be hired to do additional scripts. And then if they get a second cycle of the show, they may become showrunners or story editors. And it's built in based on broadcaster approval, producer approval, and proven writer's room approval.
Just want to chat briefly about pitching sessions. This is when, you know, you and a bunch of other writers are brought in to pitch ideas for a show, very often animation. And Jasmine, are you supposed to be paid for this when you come and pitch ideas for a show?
Yes. Last, this new agreement, it expanded the definition of story editor to include more of the pitching scenario where you're hired for a day to come in and break stories and whatnot. So yes, absolutely, we do see that as something that we cover and that you should be paid for.
Mark, what would you be looking for if you, you know, you have a reasonably experienced writer who's going in for a pitching session? What would you be asking for?
Ideally, some kind of guarantee that they'll be brought on board the show, and of course a fee for the actual session itself. That would be ideally what we try to get. But of course, if they have more writers and so on, I mean, it's always negotiation.
Would you ever feel it was useful for a writer to go into a situation where they're not guaranteed a script, but they're going to pitch a bunch of ideas?
It depends on their relationship with the producer. If it's a producer they've worked with before a few times and they have a good relationship with them and the producer has a good reputation, these producers are not going to shortchange good talent ever. They'll negotiate as anybody would. They'll negotiate to pay, not to pay so much or too much, but they're not going to shortchange good talent. There's not that much good talent out there.
Okay, there's a little tiny clause in many contracts. Well, there used to be a little clause that the writer would be added to the errors and omissions policy. Mark, would you talk about whether that's important and why and what this protects writers from and why it's getting more and more difficult to put writers on it?
Isn't there a provision in the WGC now?
Warranties and indemnities for the producer and the writer against saving them against claims, you know, and they warrant that their material is original.
But that can be very, very important, but it always depends on the kind of material you're working on.
What are you protecting the writer against with this?
Let's say you're working on a biopic of people who are still alive. How do you say this in English? Defamation? Defamation. Saying that somebody raped people or whatever. Well, that's the kind of thing that can get you sued big time. And although there is always a way for a writer to protect themselves by finding material that's in the public domain and that's been published before, let's say newspaper articles and court material and so on, there's always a risk that the people, if they're still alive, and even their estates can sue you and they can even try to prevent the film from getting made, for instance. So there is a risk. For the writer, and people who sue, they don't say, well, we'll sue this person. They'll sue the producer, the writers, the whoever, whatever they
can. Craft services person.
Yes. Anybody and their mothers and their dogs are going to get sued. That's the principle. Because one of these people in there has money. And you don't want to miss the right person, so you put everybody in the mix.
So Jasmine, under the new languages of writer, completely protected against if you're asked to write, you know, Star Wars 6 and, you know, somebody thinks they invented Ewoks.
Well, I mean, our warranties and enmities are supposed to protect a writer of third-party suits regarding that, because the writer has warranted that what they're writing is, you know, not infringing on anyone, and they have the rights to write it. And the producer, whatever they give the writer, has the right to give that to the writer and owns it. But we encourage, like, we like to see it when writers are added to the UNO insurance. It's becoming more common. All the U.S. writers who work in our jurisdiction normally have it, probably because the U.S. is a lot more litigious society, but we absolutely encourage the UNO insurance as well.
Dean, you look like you want to say something.
As counsel to the producer, I will resist naming a writer as an additional insured on the UNO policy if it's an original script which is written by the writer, because the writer is the one that should be indemnifying the producer, that the producer won't be sued. But if it's a biopic, using the example Mark gave, where the producer supplied material to the writer and told him to write the script, then I think the writer should be indemnified.
Well, let's say you know, I write a script about snipers. Isn't there a risk to me as a writer that some idiot is going to come along who thinks I wrote about him, even if I didn't, and that since I don't have the pockets that an insurance company has, that they, right, you know, should cover me?
The lawyer for the insurance company will resist naming. I know as a fact that they, in Canada, they actively resist putting writers as an additional insured.
And why are they so afraid of adding writers to the, you know?
Because they feel that it's the writer who's come up with the concept, and it's the writer's responsibility to ensure that they're not defaming or committing copyright infringement.
But, you know, just to play devil's advocate,
yeah,
many suits are not necessarily with merit, and yet they are very expensive to defend against.
I think if you use that argument, it's an argument to be had, and I think as a writer you've got to push the producer to have that as an essential condition of your engagement, but you're going to meet a lot of resistance.
So getting to the last slide here, lawsuits. We're a less litigious society than the one down south. I mean, do people ever sue people over, you know, do writers ever sue producers? Is it ever worth suing a producer? You know, is it true that you're not a real writer until you've been stiffed out of at least $50,000? Would you address that?
Well, I think a contract is a contract, and if somebody agreed to pay you a certain amount of money, you have the right to sue that person because you haven't been paid. I think it's rare a writer is going to be sued for defamation in Canada. Off the top of my head, I don't really remember. It's usually the producer, because the producer is a copyright owner in the picture, and they're the one that's deriving the revenues from exploiting the picture. So you're going to go after the person with the pockets, and you usually sue the broadcaster or the distributor of the film. But I think, you know, the purpose of a contract is that it should be honored. So if somebody doesn't honor a contract, you have the rights.
Do you, Mark, what are the consequences to a writer if they actually go after a producer who has stiffed them?
Well, if it's... I mean, what are the consequences? If it's an honest lawsuit, I mean, we have clients sometimes with not writers, because, as I said, they're so early on in the process that they get paid.
It's barely worth stiffing a writer.
but we'll have other clients that are working on the shoot directly, and, for instance, cinematographers might not get paid the post-production phase and stuff like that. I've seen that, but they're a member of Lexis or whatever, and there will be a mobilization by Axis. I imagine the same would be true of the WGC if the writer doesn't get paid. So I don't see why it would be a bad thing for a writer to sue in order to get a contract honored. However, if another kind of lawsuit is suing for copyright infringement, coming up with the idea that you sent an email to producers 7 years ago, and now the film that they've made is your idea, and you sent a three-line email with I mean, that would be ridiculous, and that's a good way of ending your career, because your reputation will be on the line.
So you don't feel that a legitimate lawsuit really endangers a writer?
Not at all. But what's legitimate? That's the difficult thing to establish. If there's a contract, easy enough. If it's copyright infringement, well, then that's a whole other ballgame. Yeah.
And if it's in the terms of the contract, they won't let you sue in a court. I mean, if it's a WGC contract, they'll send it back and say it has to be resolved under our mechanisms as far as we can take it.
Great. Well, thank you all so much for coming. I believe our hosts would like to make a brief statement.
I didn't introduce myself at the very beginning, okay? So my name is Emil Arsalan. As the president of MESLA, and my co-president here, Ivana, and Gabriel at the back, who's VP Finance, and in the name of all the other VPs of the club, we would like to thank you for coming here. So we have a little gift. Alex first. Thank you very much. Thank you. We can upload. Thank you for coming.